Shalom Aleichem, everybody. This is Binyamin Hammer at National Council of Young Israel. We are honored that we begin anew in the month of Elul, as we have 15 shilas for today, and this is conference call number 42. Thank you, Rebbe.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's good to be back after the summer. First question, please discuss the use of a tzomet microphone. For one to understand what a tzomet microphone is, one needs to first look in the article written by Harav Yisrael Rosen, who was the head of Tzomet, who was in Karim Yavne in my day, in Tchumin Chelek Tesvov, starting from page 371, it's a lengthy article, and he explains the issues which exist with respect to microphones and how they are addressed in general terms. This is not about the Tzomet microphone as such. I'm not sure if the Tzomet microphone existed in 1995 when this article was published, but as we shall see. So there are a number of issues with respect to a microphone. The first, of course, concerns electricity. And he has what he calls Os Aleph with 9 subsections, all about electricity. His conclusion is as follows. There are different kinds of microphones. Some microphones, there is a situation where by speaking into the microphone, you are creating circuitry. A new circuit exists which didn't exist beforehand. That's a serious issue about electricity. That's called apparently a dynamic microphone. They call it dinami. But there are other kinds of microphones, which he calls here kibuli or condensator, where there is a current flowing all the time. The only thing that happens when you speak into it is it gets higher, it gets lower, but it does not go on or off when you speak. This is a machlokus among the poskim, and he correctly quotes from Shlomo Zalman. Shlomo Zalman felt that it's just changing the amount of current going through. You're not creating a circuit or breaking a circuit. This in and of itself is not a violation of Hilchos Shabbos, notwithstanding that you are affecting something which is electronic in nature. Proof, hearing aids. Since hearing aids are that way, and no one asks is speaking into a hearing aid, it must be that it's not considered to be a halachic problem in such a circumstance. Okay, that takes care of the electricity perspective in this Tzomet microphone as well. Now, there are 2 additional issues which we have to discuss. One is what's called clay shear. Perhaps you should treat a microphone as a clay shear, as you are sure or aware. There's a problem of clay shear found in Shulchan Aruch, in Shin Lamed Tes, Siv Gimel. You can't play an instrument, Shem Yitaka in clay shear, based on the Sugi Masechta, Beta. There are more rights that even if you're not intending to have a shear, that's still a problem. Simon Shinlav and Chesif Alav even talks about knocking on a door with a ring. This is a problem even today in certain circumstances. The question becomes, what about in our situation? So in fact, Rabbi Waldenberg, he quotes in the Tshuva, Tzitz Eliezer, Chelik Dalet Simen Chavav, says he's seen many times that microphones, you know, they go wrong a little bit, you have to play with them a little bit, and therefore there's an issue of Shem Yitak and Klesh. Of course, he's bothered, but what about a hearing aid? They also have to be adjusted from time to time. Of course, it could be that the hearing aid adjustment is in fact permissible. Many posts can say you're allowed to make it higher or lower for the very same reason we mentioned before. You're only changing the amount of current as opposed to when a microphone goes bad, it could be it involves much more than that. A real tikkun, unplugging it, plugging it back in again, and making all kinds of changes that many of us have seen in public lectures when the microphone goes bad, it starts to screech, and people start to try to fix it. Not just a matter of a slight adjustment up or down as you have with respect to a hearing aid. This is a significant issue of Shem Yitakein klesh here. Others say that it's not called a klesh here in the first place. It's not meant to either have a tune or even similar to the Ramaz situation of also the Hakas for Shabbos Haladelis for Tabasa Kavua Bedelis Kli Miyuchel Lekach. The issue may be there the Ramo contrast is Mekil Shon Mishkolas and Mekashkes Lishos grandfather clock. Okay, so there are certain limitations. Apparently, it's only prohibited where the Chazal prohibited it, which is called Hashmos Kol the Klishir, either Maisei Adam, play a guitar, things of this nature. And you shouldn't extend it to things which are happening without anything being done by the individual. Here is just speaking into it, as he suggests that speaking into it, not the same as doing it by hand. That's his suggestion over here in this article. He tries to get out of this problem of Shem Yitaka and Kleshir. And the Zomit microphone takes care of this in an additional way, which of course not every microphone does. They have a way of stopping it to what they call a grumma device, which is a subject unto itself. And they lock it up, and the key is held by the rabbi. And therefore, there's no question, no real chash of Shem Yitaka and Kleshir. Before we go on, we should add that since the microphones have come a long way since 1995, it's an additional issue. Today, many, many electronic devices have all kinds of lights going on and off, panels, things are written, and that's all eliminated in the Tzomet microphone to take care of these, we'll call them secondary problems. And therefore, he believes there's no problem of Shem Yitaka and Kleshir, because you're only speaking into it. You're not strumming it, if I may use that example. That's a chiddush. Not so posh that he's right, but that's what he wants to get out of the issue of Shem Yitaka and Kleshir with respect to a microphone. Again, his proof is from the Shon Mishkolos, the grandfather clock, and there it's permissible. One could argue that there you set the clock on Friday, you didn't do anything on Shabbos. Here you're speaking into the microphone on Shabbos. Speaking into the microphone, arguably, could be compared to strumming a guitar. You're doing something. And that's where the details come in. It's not so simple. Okay, that's as far as Shem Yitaka and Kleshir is concerned. Perhaps another potential, even a bigger problem, is what's called Mashmia Kol, Avsha Milsa, maybe Maris Ayin. And these are all halacha categories which are found, take a look on Siman Reish Nun Beis Sifhei in the Ramah, where he talks about this. And it's based upon the Gemara and Masechta Shabbos Yud Ches, Einosin Chitin L'Tocha Rechayim Shalmayim Ne'ashmoas Kol, Rashi says, Avsha Milsa V'Shabbos Vika Zilusa. Zilusa when so much noise is being made on Shabbos. That's the kind of Uvda D'Chol, according to Rashi. Okay. As a matter of fact, the Dake Moshe in Reish Nun Beis quotes those who say it's prohibited to have a grandfather clock set before Shabbos for this precise reason of Avsha Milsa makes a lot of noise. The Dake Moshe there quotes a heter. Why? Because if it's the case of the Gemara, Yizbru Shanos Nesachitim B'Tocha Rechayim B'Shabbos. It's a Maris Ayin case. But Kliya Mishkolas, and here's an important quotation, HaKol Yodim Sherigilim L'Takno B'Chol Yom Al Yom She'acharav. Everybody knows that they would set this clock on Friday to make noise on Shabbos. U'Yom Shumakashke Shumashmiya Kolim L'Takno. So they don't know anything at that day. This is the heter which is found in the Dake Moshe from the Ogur, and it seems to pass on our way the halacha lemaisa in Siman Reish Nun Beis Sif Hey. And therefore, Rav Rosen comes to the conclusion that the entire Isser of Avshamilsa is because of what he calls a Maris Ayin, not because of Zilusa. We don't pass on Zilusa because we're Matir, the grandfather clock. And Maris Ayin would not apply in this particular case of the Somet microphone. Why wouldn't it apply to the Somet microphone? Why isn't there a situation? They'll think you put it on Shabbos. So he writes as follows. You have this machshir. Let's say put on with a Shabbos clock. It won't be different than putting on an air conditioner or a light to a Shabbos clock. Everyone knows it's okay. We're not worried about Avshem Milsa Maris Ayin. Put a big sign up. It says it's a Sutzomet, and et cetera, et cetera. This, of course, is not a simple matter at all. Number one, the Mishnah Berurah does mention the idea of Zilusa de Shabbos, which, although the Shulchan Aruch himself may be not applying it because he accepts the heter of the grandfather clock, one could make a distinction. He, Rav Rosen, is wondering why all the poskim are talking about Zilusa de Shabbos, which we don't poskim that way. He thinks the Ramah quotes it, but he seems to reject it based on the grandfather clock. And therefore, all those who quote Avshem Milsa in terms of Zilusa de Shabbos, in his words, Nishtapshu Bedover. They made a mistake. That's not quite the case, because the Mishnah Berurah does mention that Svara, even though it has to be tempered with the fact that the Ramah is Mekel when it comes to the grandfather clock. The bigger problem is that the facts of the microphone do not line up directly with the facts of the grandfather clock. And the Ogre says, and Ramah quotes it as such, only if everybody knows that the normal way is to set it up from Friday. That's the normal way. So then Chazal never made a gzera. In the case of the microphone, everybody knows the other way is true. The average person sets up a microphone just before someone's about to speak, and therefore this comparison is incorrect. And as a matter of fact, the one who says so explicitly is Reb Shlomo Zalman. Shlomo Zalman is the one who's usually the pesach for the Tzomet, but not in this case. Here he says as follows. This is found in Mincha Shlomo Chelek Aleph Simen Tes. He talks about this precise idea, mentions the lashon of the poskim. That's well known that it's always done before Shabbos. So he says as follows. He says that it doesn't help that you put up a Shabbos clock. It doesn't help you put up a sign. No. Chazal asked it no matter what. No matter what. It's an absolute kind of a low plug. A low plug. And the only time that it's permissible is the case of the Zuga Mekashkesh, because everybody knows that the normal way to do it is on one day for the next day. Whereas when it comes to a microphone, it's not that case. And again, he quotes direct quotation from the Dake Moshe. Again, Shakol Yodim Shavigil Natakla B'chol Yom Al Yom Shal Achrof. He quotes the same thing from the Shulchan Aruch Harav. Shkenu Dako Liolam Lamidol B'chol Yom Al Yom Shal Achrof. Now quoting Rav Shlomo Zalman. Ma'ashenkin Ebederach Klalo Hoya Regil Nakonis Hashon B'chol Yom Al Yom Shal Achrof. Hoya Osa Lahashar Hashon. So therefore, that's only in cases of a light and other things which is normally done the day before, but a microphone is normally done right then and there, and therefore he thinks it would be a problem. So the bottom line is, in my opinion, it's a problem. Now, the main thrust of Rabbi Rosen is, listen, if you're not going to be matter a microphone, shouldn't be matter a hearing aid either. Ramosh is a tshuva explicitly about the distinctions between one and the other. He correctly points out Rabbi Rosen, that's not so poshut what Rabbi Moshe is saying. We made a distinction between Shem and Yitakein. There can also be a distinction Av Shemilsa, it's only if it's loud and the hearing aid is not loud, which is a very important distinction. Therefore, bottom line is that despite Rabbi Rosen's claim that's double or nothing, we split. We allow hearing aids and we do not allow microphones. He makes a further point that there's no difference between the electric microphone of Tzomet and the air microphones that some people are advocating nowadays. I remember that literally 25 years ago, when the Vad Halacha of the RCA existed, I was asked to write about air microphones, and I came to a very similar conclusion as Rabbi Rosen, except he thinks they're both mutter, I think they're both usher. But that they're comparable, I believe, is something which is correct. Again, I wrote it 4 years before this came out. But the opposite conclusion, I thought there's a problem in both situations. So the bottom line is that so many microphones, I'm trying to discuss it as much as I can in the limited time. If someone wants to rely upon it, if they have to hear from Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli and from Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, the Rebbe of Tel Aviv, and Rabbi Toledano, who is from London, I think maybe in Eretz Yisrael it's more common here in this country. In Orthodox shuls, it's very, very rare, very rare. I think it really shouldn't be done. It's if we accept it upon ourselves in this country, the Psak L'Chumra, and I don't think any rabbi has a right to put it into a shul. Those who were grandfathered in from before, it's a different story. They may have an earlier precedent. But if it's a question of the mitzvah, should you put it in? The answer is no. And the problem will be, but people can't hear. It's a problem. The rabbi has to speak in a loud voice, and hope the chazanim and the balkaris and the olim will speak in a loud voice as well. This is the best way out of the microphone problem. Question two. Teletherapy and Shabbos, Yom Tov issues. A congregant owns a teletherapy practice in which they hire speech therapists to provide services to patients long distance via computer cameras. They would like to hire Jewish speech therapists in Israel to work with patients via computer on Saturday morning, afternoon in the U.S., after Shabbos in Israel. A, is there a Shabbos issue for the Jewish therapist in Israel to provide therapy via computer for patients in the U.S. when it's Shabbos in the U.S. after Shabbos in Israel? B, is it permissible for the therapy practice owners in the U.S. to profit from the work being done in this fashion on Shabbos for patients in the U.S. but by therapists after Shabbos in Israel? The first question is I think, a straightforward answer. If the patient is not Jewish, it's okay. If the patient is Jewish, it's not okay. Because if the patient is Jewish, then the teletherapist in Israel is being machshel, the Jew, to participate on his computer camera on Shabbos. That's not allowed. As opposed to the non-Jew who's doing it for his own purpose of therapy, it would be okay. As far as making money on it, it's permissible. It's not an issue of Schar Shabbos because it involves Havlah. Havlah means there are many expenses have to be covered in order to be able to do this, and therefore I believe it's permissible for the owner to profit while he lives in America, even though it's being done in America by someone in Israel, because again, it's a question of Havlah. He's not profiting directly just for this moment, like a babysitter or something like that, but rather it's based on a whole series of expenses that he has during the week, and therefore it's considered Havlah. Question three. Typically, we have a very hard time getting a minyan for Slichas. This is for a minyan in a retirement community. It's been very common to get through most or sometimes all of the slichas without being able to say the Shlosh Tremidus. Rav Moshe's mat is a horaz shah to say slichas at night. I suspect that if I did that, my minyan would be very well attended. Most of the attendees would probably be non-residents of our retirement community for whom the horaz shah shouldn't apply. I have heard that there are some poskim who prefer slichas at mincha over slichas after ma'arif, but that is impractical and wouldn't work. A. So what would be a bigger b'di'evet, slichas after ma'arif with a minyan, or before shachas with just a few participants and rarely saying the shlosh nemidus? B. Is there a hakpada to say slichas before davening, or if logistically works better davening shachas first, i.e., can daven until you stop up without a minion, and then slichas after. Very important question. If you look carefully, the very beginning of Tavkul Fayalov, the Mishnah Brura, and the Shara Tshuva are very opposed to saying slichas before Chatzos. Rabbi Vadya quotes in Yechav Adas the full quote of Rav Moshe Zakuta, who was only quoted briefly in the Shara Tshuva. So someone who says slichas before Chatzos on any day except for Yom Kippur is a kotzis v'netiyus, and it's much better to say nothing. Don't say the Yud Gimel Midas at that time. It's not as a man of rachim, it's as a man of din, and it's better to say nothing than to say something. You want to say piyutim, you want to say whatever you want to say, that's fine, but not the Yud Gimel Midas at that point in time. And therefore, notwithstanding Rav Moshe so raw as Shah, remember his case was people were afraid to walk out in the street when it was dark outside. So that knocked out the early morning. It was a frightful time at 5 o'clock in the morning. It was still scared. Whereas at night, and people were walking around the streets at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night, it was safer in the streets of the Lower East Side at the time. In our cases, it's almost non-existent that kind of a circumstance. So to extrapolate from Rav Moshe's of Rosh Hashanah to today, again, it's almost impossible. You're referring to a case where it's dangerous to walk on the streets at a different time. We thank God, B'liyan Hara in America today, that danger almost doesn't exist. And if I think it's inappropriate to extend Rav Moshe's kula to other situations. And again, most possible are the Rav Moshe's kula in the first place. They say if you can't do it, it's your potter. You cannot. I said you're going to be this before Chatzos. You'll tell me, but this is, sounds like it's esoteric. The answer is, but Slichas is also esoteric. So the same Yud Gimel Midas that we say to implore Hashem to give us Midas Arachim, as we don't fully understand it, we have to go with the rules by those who know what these things mean. And they say before Chatzos, it may not be done. So that's my take on this matter. It simply may not be done. I know that it's against very common practice because, as often happens, a Hora Shah becomes a Hora Olam. That's why Hora Shahs are very difficult to make. It's a general principle in Psak. I wonder if Rav Moshe knew that, who knows, decades and decades after his Psak, this is tremendous zilzal. People for all kinds of convenience, purely convenience reasons are saying tzichas at 10 o'clock at night, and not when it should be said. I wonder if he ever would have issued the Psak in the first place. Could be he would have said, just don't do tzichas, that's all. I don't know, can't speak for Rav Moshe, but that seems to me a halachic policy of a Rosh Hashanah. If you know in advance, it's going to lead to a tremendous zilzal. Perhaps a Rosh Hashanah shouldn't be given. And if it's something that becomes butler for a little while, so just can't help it. Let me go back to the issue at hand. It seems to me two things. Number one, the idea of after mincha is found in Yechav Adas. I do not understand the questioner. It's impractical and it wouldn't work. I know it does work. In Riverdale, a certain shul was saying stilus at night, and someone from my shul convinced him, instead of saying it at 9 o'clock at night, to say it right after between mincha and maariv. Rabbi Avadia is making to say Yud Gimel Midas for up to the Bein HaShemeshes period. It's a very nice, you know, way to connect mincha to maariv. Certainly before Rosh Hashanah, and probably even in Aseret Yemei Teshuva, you can finish all the Yud Gimel Midas when it's still called Bein HaShemeshes. It depends how you define it exactly. You always start mincha a few minutes earlier, and then you daven maariv. So everyone's around for the combination of mincha and tzichos and maariv, and it's usually late enough. This year happens to be a little bit earlier because Yom Hashanah is late, but even so, it's in the evening hours and people can make it. Of course, if you're a lawyer and you work till 10 o'clock, you can't make it. I don't think you can make the 10 o'clock tzichos either, even though I know there's some hours in between. I think it can work, and maybe they should try it in this retirement community. It'll have fakert. It'll help the mincha maariv minyan to work better. Okay, but let's say it cannot be done for whatever reason. So I just have a simple question. They say there's a minyan every day. The only time there's a hard time is for slichas. People come late. In my view, what you should do is start the regular time. Start the regular time. Retirement community, people aren't working. So if they normally daven at, let's say, 7 o'clock, and they wanted to say slichas at 6:30, no, slichas at 7 o'clock. So shakos will start at 7:30. So in a non-retirement community, people are going to run out. They have to go to work. In a retirement community, they'll just stay later. I'm not sure why that can't be an easy option. if indeed there is a time crunch, if there's indeed a time crunch, so then I still think it should start at the regular time, maybe a tiny bit earlier, and be mekater in the slichas, al derech the slichas of Erev Yom Kippur. That's the shortest slichas. We leave out most of the long recitations. We have just the Yud Gimel Midas and a couple of piyutim in between. If you can pattern yourself after that and leave out all the other ideas, that should be permissible to be done if there's no other alternative. As far as slichas after shachris, that's not a way to go. Slichas has to go before shachris. If a particular individual has a funny schedule and has to daven on a particular day, shachris followed by slichas, from a second minyan, for example, that's okay. But that the minyan should have slichas after shachris, that's not the minyan Yisrael and cannot be done. Question number 4. Vitamins and minerals. Person takes B12 sublingual first thing in the morning. Must dissolve under his tongue without water. Does he make a shackle? No. That's not a food. That's just a medicine. Calcium citrate is a chewable, unflavored mineral. He needs to chew it so it dissolves better. Again, without water. Does he make a bracha? The answer again is no. It's a food. It's not a food at all. What about chewable flavored vitamins? Depends who you ask. I asked someone who told me, that tastes like candy. The fact that it's called flavored vitamins is meaningless. It reminds me when I was a child, we used to have cough drops all the time. It was called cough drops. From our perspective, it was pure candy. So of course you make a shahakal on that. So again, I'm not familiar with chewable flavored vitamins, but if in fact it's treated like candy, then the shahakal should be made. Question number 5. Family of a young man who passed away young but was cremated wants to make a donation to the shul in his memory. Can we take the donation and put up a plaque in the shul? What about taking a donation in memory of someone who was intermarried? These are all very, very serious questions. On a simple basis, as a matter of policy, since both being cremated, I assume the man requested to be cremated, and intermarrying are very negative activities, very, very serious negative activities. It would not be appropriate to honor such an individual and put up a plaque. It means a plaque. You know, the Rashba writes, we put up plaques for those who get stuck because Mepharsim and Osei Mitzvah, and people should follow suit. Here, Chas V'Shalom, you put up a plaque for someone who did this, I can also intermarry. There'll be a plaque for me. I can also be cremated. There'll be a plaque for me. So I think it's very, very wrong as a deterrent to further cremations and intermarriages. It should not be done, and it's just inappropriate. That's as a general policy. Every rule has its exceptions. It's hard for me to give a definitive answer to every circumstance, every situation. There could be situations in which by doing this, it'll lead to the kiruv of an entire family. It'll lead to maybe to the an ability of the shul to do wonderful things. It's very hard for me to make absolute prohibitions. So to summarize, I believe it really normally shouldn't be done. Perhaps it could be in exceptional cases. Of course, the exceptional case has to be determined by the local rav to see how exceptional it is, and perhaps he should ask someone else who is not so nogeh b'davar to see if it in fact qualifies as an exception. Number 6. Can you take out a non-Jewish client to a non-kosher restaurant, wine, and dine him? Of course, the mespal will not be eating anything. The answer is it's permissible as long as it's clear to everybody that the mispalel is not eating anything. So it depends how he walks in. If he walks in with a business attire, with an attaché case or a laptop or whatever it may be, it's clearly going in for business. People will not suspect him of going to eat. They'll understand that there are situations of Jews and non-Jews meeting in restaurants. Not always is it possible to go to a kosher one just to try. And he's just going in there, and he won't eat anything. I can go further than that. He's allowed to sip Coca-Cola, which is clearly kosher, or eat an apple. But something which is either non-kosher or looks non-kosher, you certainly shouldn't eat because of marasayim. Can you send a non-Jewish client a non-kosher cooked turkey with trimmings for Thanksgiving? The answer is yes. The cooked turkey is also b'achila with mutar b'hana. Send a non-kosher wine or candy. Well, non-kosher candy is really not that non-kosher. I'm not sure what's really in it. It certainly wouldn't have an Easter hana. Whereas non-kosher wine, technically speaking, because Medina de Gemara is also b'hana, so you can't do it. If you look in Yerodea, some Kuf Chav Gimel, Kuf Chav Dal, you'll find that many posts can maintain that b'zman hazeh, nowadays, the non-Jews are not really bowing down to Avodah Zarah as they used to, but rather minig avoseim b'yodeim. So therefore, the remaining Isser of Stam Yenam is primarily an Isser of Chasnus. You shouldn't come to socialize and then intermarry, which would presumably be limited to an Isser Shtiyah, and not extend to an Isser Hanah. Those who follow that Ramah have a right to be lenient even with non-kosher wine. If you follow the Mechaber, or you want to be Machber, send non-kosher candy instead. Question number 7. In general, can a Kohen and Avelis Duchen? This Sukkos, he may be the only Kohen in Shul, can he, does he Duchen? It's a big argument among the Poskim, very big argument. I can't decide who's right. Some Avelim do Duchen, some don't Duchen. On a simple level, Meikar Dina should certainly Duchen, because it's a mitzvah sase. It could be a thing.
Rebbe, are you there?
Of the Rebbe, Rebbe here.
Rebbe, we lost you for about a minute. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I don't know what it
is. But when?
Rebbe just started answering the question. We lost you.
About a coin?
Yeah.
Good. We'll start again. Question number 7. In general, can a coin and avelis duchen? This Sukkos may be the only Kohen in Shul. Does he Duchen? So, there's a big fight among the Poskim and Simon Kuf Chav Ches and Arachayim. Should an Avil Duchen or should he not Duchen? Of course, in Shiva, you don't Duchen. That's for sure. There's no Duchen in a base Avil. But beyond that, may he or may he not. So from the perspective of Shel and Shalom, of course, it's permissible. But the question is, he's not Besimcha. So I suggested a possible distinction between Chutzlorz and Eretz Yisrael. And Eretz Yisrael, he can duchen every day, because they're not worried about lack of simcha in general. They duchen every day, despite the Ramos, we're not the simcha. When the Chutzlorz, there are those who are more machmir, because the same as we don't duchen, even if it's not an Avelis, almost the whole year, except for 13 days a year, we don't duchen, because we are not in such a good mood. So therefore, an Avel, even on those 13 days, is not in such a good mood. So there is a strong meaning in that direction. But at the same time, there are many Gedolei Poskim who say that a Kohen can Duchen, even though it's in the Shloshim Yud Beis Kodesh. I think it's a good meaning where it exists. And in the Shas HaTzchak, where he's the only Kohen, I would certainly say you can rely upon that point of view. Question number 8. A few parents in Shul have asked that for the sake of Chinuch, I should allow non-bar mitzvah boys aged 10, 11, and 12 to read the Haftorah. Please discuss the issue. All right. This is discussed in the Ramah, quotes a minig, that the Gemara has a Masechta Megillah, Daf Chav Gimel Amud Aleph. Hachal Olam Yeminyan Shiva Afilu Katan. So Katan is permitted to do so. The minig is that a katan is not the balkare. That's the Magen Avraham says, others disagree. And here he's reading the haftorah, somewhat of a balkare. One of the reasons given for the Magen Avraham is that if he's a balkare, he's in effect reading every single aliyah. And hakol olam minyan shiva, many rishonim and poskim say, means only olam. He's only one or some. Can't have a Kriya Sator with 7 Ketanim that you cannot have. And if the person is a Balkoria for all seven aliyahs, it's the equivalent of seven ketanim getting aliyahs. That logic would not apply to the Haftorah. The Haftorah is only one after the other seven. And as a matter of fact, in some circles, there's a strong custom to call up a bar mitzvah bacha the Shabbos before his bar mitzvah to mafter. Where we come from, they call him the Shabbos after bar mitzvah to mafter, even if he's not laying the whole parsha. Maybe he'll lay only a mafter. But in other circles, they call him up for mafter the Shabbos before his bar mitzvah. They clearly hold it's permissible, even according to the minig that we don't normally give aliyahs to ketanim. Mafter is more lenient, not more strict. And therefore, one could justify doing this as it's done in certain circles. The most important question, of course, is what is the minig of the shul? If the minig of the shul is never to give bar mitzvah bachurim before the age of 13, I'm very hesitant to change minhagim. Very hesitant. Chinuch is important, yes, but menhagim are menhagim. And if the shul until now has been there for a long time, never gave a babacha before 13, except for Simchas Torah, or except in Rav Moshe's case, where they taught him the wrong parsha, they miscalculated his name as bar mitzvah. Okay, that's an exception. Rav Moshe allows him to learn the entire parsha, and after, presumably. But in a normal situation, I would be very hesitant to change a minhag of previous years, and I think it's better in those cases to not allow the cotton under 13 to get the Haftorah. Aside from the chinuch, you know, for the other considerations, even with respect to chinuch, it's arguable that the bacha has his first aliyah and his bar mitzvah. That's a very important milestone and a goal, etc., as opposed to if he did it when he was 10 already, it doesn't, bar mitzvah is lose some of its oomph. Question number 9. Can somebody wearing open toe sandals get an aliyah? Everybody else in the shul wears shoes. The Balkori was standing next to him feels adamantly not. There's a returning new member who left and came back. The Balkori is certainly entitled to his opinion, but if he, for example, is the only person who thinks adamantly not and everyone thinks it's okay, it's very difficult to reject such an individual. Now, the fact that everybody wears shoes, that's a much bigger consideration. The fellow should be spoken to and say, listen, when you're here, everyone here wears shoes. Look around you. Everyone's wearing shoes. So it's forget about halacha, forget about hashkafa, as a matter of common courtesy. If everyone in the shul presents in a certain way and you have the ability to do so, you know, if everyone has a beard, you have no beard, you can't put one on. But if everyone is wearing shoes and you have the ability when you come to the shul next time to put on shoes instead of open-toe sandals, it's only common courtesy to do such a thing. So I would tell him that that's what he should try to do going forward. But if someone already called him up or he comes with the sandals, he has yard sight or something, strictly speaking, it's permissible unless it's a situation where everybody in the shul doesn't want it. The fact that the Balkari doesn't want it does not disqualify him automatically. Question number 10. Assuming it isn't the seventh day, wedding was Monday or later, what is the proper procedure for Sheva Brochas and Suda Shlishit if it's after Shkia and even after Tzeis? A, is the Vayar Aser said? Yes. For those who say the Vayar Aser, in Israel they don't say the Vayar Aser on Shabbos, but we say it. B, are all Sheva Brochas recited, including Hagafen? Again, yes. Who does or does not drink the wine? Okay. Let's first answer D. Do we save a kos for Abdullah? Again, the answer is yes. Most shuls bench every Shabbos with a kos for Birchas HaMazon, Sefer for Avdala. The same thing is done over here. So we go back to see who does or does not drink the wine. The answer is that you don't drink from the kos of Birchas HaMazon, which goes for the Havdalah. You do drink from the kos of Sheva Brachas. Six Brachas are made. The seventh Brachas is made by none other than the Chassan. The Chassan makes Bar Pri HaGafen since he's the most connected to the Sheva Brachos, he drinks from the kos, he puts it down, the kal drinks from the kos, that's our minhag, the kal drinks from the kos, and the third kos that normally the mevarech of Birchas HaMazon drinks from, sometimes it mixes the kosos, but drinks from, that is saved for Avdalah, and they do it after Marv. E, in general, is pano chadash required for shalashudas? The answer is yes. The poskim say, for the other Shabbos meals, you don't require pano chadash. But for Shalashudas, we do require. Some say if you say a drush, it's it substitutes. That reminds me of the famous Beis Halevi. The Beis Halevi said that the Chassidim, they would rely on the Chassidish Torah instead of Shalashudas. So the Beis Halevi responded, there's a problem. Even if it's true, which it's not, it's based upon a Zohar, which is limited to a case of Erev Pesach Shechal B'Shabbos, or of Shimba Yochoi, said Torah. There was no alternative because of the Gro. You couldn't have challah or matzah in the afternoon, you couldn't do it in the morning, and other foods wouldn't work. But forgetting that for the moment, the Beis Halevi said, the problem is that if he says this, some of the Rebbe says Torah, and you fulfill Shalashudas, I hear the Torah and I slug up the Torah, so you want yours to Shalashudas, but you can't slug up a piece of challah and gefilte fish. Same thing over here. Some say it's Russia would be good enough for Panach Hadashas, but if you slug it up, so therefore, one should not rely upon that sheet. Number 11. An elderly Baal Tshuva of 10 years, couple, is making a 50th wedding anniversary and want to renew their vows. Since they did not want this to be an empty ritual, and they asked me to see if they were really married according to Halacha, and if not, could I marry them? The marriage was done by a rabbi of a conservative temple who was trained in Berlin and was reported to be showing a mitzvah. The ksuba they showed me from the marriage seemed to be fine, but the eidim for it and for the condition was the chazan of the shul, in other words, the shul which has conservative temple, and I have no reports of him being Shomer Mitzvah. The community back then had a very low percentage of observant Jews, perhaps 5%. I was planning on making a new ksuba, the Yerchasa, and a kiddushin with a chuppah, only with a gofen. I am assuming I should not say Birkas Eretz in any Sheva Brachos. Is this approach correct? Very long question with a very important punchline. The punchline of the question, before we even get to the question, is this couple is not unique. There are many Baalei Tshuva, Baruch Hashem, who are married by non-Orthodox clergy who come close to Yiddishkeit. And the truth is, if the rabbi has his druthers, he should go over to every one of them and ask who you did your wedding. And if it's an unsatisfactory answer, which likely it is, the rabbi should do the wedding again. Most rabbanim don't do that. And there's grounds to believe as follows. Rav Moshe the Tshuva, that conservative and reform marriages are usually invalid because they don't do things properly. They're on kosher edim. And although what happens to an Orthodox wedding, if the kosher edim are in the back, the Tshuva's chasam sofer is an ansadeh because they're probably going to do it right. That is not applied to a non-Orthodox rabbi. In our best, we always try to make sure there were no Shomer Shabbos Edim in the hall at all, but it's arguable that if they were sitting in the back and didn't see, that they're not married either. And this, of course, is relevant when the couple breaks up without a get. Shabbos of Mamzeret, Shabbos of Meshesish. So we're generally speaking, we look for kulas that they were never married, because they were not observant, and the rabbi wasn't observant, and there were no real witnesses. We try very hard to reach that conclusion to avoid problems of either Eishes Ish or Mamzeres. However, to my mind, that leniency applies in the average case of these situations where the individuals were never observant. They were never observant. So now, a generation later, there's a question of a mamzeris, or they become Baal Tshuvas subsequently, but at the time that they were married, they were never observant. Then I think we have a right to assume a significant leniency. What happened to the rule of Ein Adam Osi Bilas to Bilas Nus? Number one is the problem of the Eidim. Maybe there are no Eidim at the wedding, and maybe there are no kosher Eidim in the neighborhood where they live. If there are, you run into that potential problem. But the Rove Poskim say, what? That's only true for an observant couple. Well, they don't want to be involved intimately in a prohibited fashion. But if they're not observant, they don't keep the laws of Taras HaMishpacha. They don't keep any of these of the halachas between husband and wife in the bedroom. So why should they be concerned that it's called a Bias Nus? I never heard of it being a Bias Nus in the absence of a proper religious ceremony. So therefore, we assume that they're not married. But what happened if they become Baalei Tshuva? Here, they're 10 years Baalei Tshuva. It's hard to believe that in the 10 years of being Baalei Tshuva, they never heard that there's a problem with a non-Orthodox clergy. It doesn't make sense. So therefore, it's certainly arguable that when they became observant and they lived together as normally as husband and wife, they had in mind that this living together should in fact be a good kiddushin. It's called Ishanikas Babia. And therefore, in my mind, we cannot allow them to separate without a get. The child would be a serious issue, a very serious issue. The marriage, in my view, was a marriage, a valid marriage from the time they became Baalei Tshuva. And if there was a get afterwards, the woman cannot, is not allowed to marry a Kohen. I'm saying all this because there seem to be individuals who disagree and say even in that kind of a case, we can assume they were never married, and I find this difficult to accept. So therefore, getting back to our case, it's very possible that they're already married. I wouldn't say it for sure, but certainly possible. So therefore, the proper course of action is exactly as the rabbi thought, to make a new ksuba, to make a new kiddushin with a chuppah, only the bar prayer gofen, because safek brachos lahakel, both with respect to the birchas erison and the sheva brachos, and therefore, it should be done this way without a bracha. Question number 12. Most people in my shul don't do Atarah Sedarim. Should we read it together on Erev Rosh Hashanah and have three people who do it, who would do it on their own respond as a Beis Din? That would still only help those in shul on Erev Rosh Hashanah. Should we rely on Kol Nidrei for the majority of people that don't do it? The truth is that Atarah Sedarim of Erev Rosh Hashanah is a very, very widespread custom, but it probably doesn't work. Everyone who says that Atarah Sedarim, we all say it, people all say it, and after they finish their long bakosha, very, very long, they make the following semi-disclaimer, printed in just about every single siddur. Mitzad adin, you have to live for a neder, but I can't do it. And therefore, even though I didn't do it, it's as if I did it. It's like Nishkan Shabbos Geret, and you say whatever you want on Shabbos. If you have to be poured, you have to be poured. I don't see how it works. I mean, there are those who give difficult answers. In my view, it probably doesn't work. And therefore, the tzibur should be educated. Instead of doing Atarah Sedarim in such a fashion, if they have a particular neder in mind, they should do it the regular way. Go to three people and ask them, I took this neder or that neder, and perhaps you can give me Atarah Sedarim. Or Kol Nidre should be explained to them carefully. Kol Nidre is not past-oriented. It's, our text is future-oriented. Although the text in most Machzorim is contradictory. It's Yom Kippurim, Yom Kippurim, Bolein, and Latova, but some of the verb forms are past. If you correct it, as you should, it's future. It's called the Mesiras Modah, and you prevent the neder from taking place in advance. It doesn't have validity because you took it away. It's a Modah. That only applies in a case where you forgot when you took this neder in haste or anger during the year that you forgot you said Kol Nidre. If you remember it and say, I don't care about Kol Nidre, then it would take effect, but that's a rarity. So Kol Nidre, it seems to me, halachically, is a better vehicle, but people should understand what it is, and everyone's a shul for Kol Nidre. So you should educate them either then or earlier. This is what Kol Nidre means. Everyone should say with strong kavana to knock out any future nadar. That's a better device for the general population that's not going to bother doing a proper Atarah Sedarim when they tell the three judges what the neder was, then you're better off with the Kol Nidre than the Hataras Dharm, which is typically done in Erev Rosh Hashanah. 13. When is the earliest time that one can make Kiddush on the first night of Rosh Hashanah, Sukkos, and on Shmini Atzeres? Rosh Hashanah, in theory, you can make it early Rosh Hashanah, like any other Shabbos or Yontif. It's not normally done, but in theory, you can make it from Plag HaMincha, which is an hour and a quarter before sunset. They may do that in certain senior centers. There's no limitation on that. Sukkos is a bit different because Sukkos is supposed to make the bracha in the sukkah, leisha b'sukkah on Kiddush. And the said in the post can quote that just as on Pesach night, be'erev toflu matzis must be done dafka ba'layla hazeh, rochlus abosa ba'layla hazeh, only at night, and there's a hekesh of matzah to Pesach, Korban Pesach. So too, since Sukkos is compared, Tetzvav, You're not supposed to eat the kibetza, kazayas pas, till after tzetzik achavim, and kiddush should come right before. So therefore, kiddush shouldn't really be done a bit later on Sukkot. It should be done ideally after tzetzik achavim, the same as the Mogen Avraham paskins on Seder night. The kaddish should be after tzetzik achavim. Here it's not as important for two reasons. One, here the kiddush not part of the Arba Kaisis, and then number two, it's only an extension. But at the same time, kiddush, you shouldn't make an early sukkahs. That's going to lead to a michshel of eating the kazayas before shkia, before tzeis, potentially without yotzeis, so you should daven sukkahs later. Of course, if you daven sukkahs in your shul right after shkia, till people get home, it's probably after tzeis kachavim, so if that's necessary, it can be done. Shmini Atzeres is a different issue. Shmini Atzeres is an issue of what about Hoshana Rabbah? The Taz and the Marshal about making Tosefes Shabbos on Shmini Atzeres, Tosefes Yontov, I should say. Some say yes, some say no. The minig is not to. So once again, the kiddush should be made after dark. If really necessary, you can daven as early as Shkia and then get home. Everyone gets home after the Tezek HaChavim. In many other shuls, they wait on all 3 days, Rosh Hashanah, Sukkot, and Shmini Atzeres, till after the early version of Tzeis Kachavim, in order to even to daven Ma'ariv, and certainly for the to make Kiddush. Okay, 14. Is there an Inyan to do the Simanim on the second night also? Well, Machlokos and the various Menhagim, we look on the Shari Tshuva, Siman Tov Kuf Pei Gimel Sifkot and Aleph. The Piskei Tshuva here talks about the different Menhagim. Every family should do what its Minig is. If they use the Siman on the second night, they should continue to do so, and if not, not. Question number 15. Do the Tkiyas need to be timed? Is sounding long enough good? Tkiyas longer than the middle sounds? Well, the answer is, sounding long enough is good, as long as the Tkiyas longer than the middle sounds, but sometimes it's hard to be precise. How do you keep this in your head? Rav Moshe has in one place, in one of the Torah Lahara, I believe, that he thought that the Tkiyah should be 2 seconds for Tashat and Tarat, and therefore 4 seconds for Tashrat. That's pretty long, pretty long. There's a very wonderful Jew here in Washington named Rav Chaim Ashkenazi. He's an expert in this field. He's the one who apparently discovered the 18-minute gap in the Nixon tapes many years ago. And he gave me his graph of how long it took him to blow the three Shvarims and the 9 Truas, and therefore the Tashrat together. And my recollection is it took not 4 seconds, as Rav Moshe said, but rather 2.5 seconds. So 2.5 to 3 seconds should be enough for this, for the shear of the Tkiyah and the Tashrat, as being as long or longer than the Shvarim Trua in between. Now, how do you measure 3 seconds in your head? I guess they tell me that the certain sports where there's a 3-second rule, so the ref has to keep the 3 seconds in his head. But when I find my Dragon, so I would say it's better to time it. When I'm the Makri for the first 30 kolos, so I have my watch, and I just look down a little bit to make sure it's 3 seconds. Then I nod my head, so the Baal Tkiyah can stop right there and not exert himself out of doubt, because maybe it's not long enough. So and if, even without it, we used to, in the old days, with counting seconds, also a sports analogy, we say either 1 Mississippi or 1 1,000, depends how many syllables you need. 4 syllables or 3 syllables, or machlekes apparently, depends how fast you say the words. So you should try to get it to be 3 seconds, and it's pinched 2.5 seconds in the Tashrat and Tashat, in the Tashrat. Tashat and Tarat, Mikir Adin, it's enough 1.25 to 1.5 seconds, which is a very small shear, which is almost automatic in every single case. I want to thank everyone for listening to the questions after the summer break. I'm sorry for a little bit too long on the first question, but it was a very complicated and important question. I wish everybody a ksiva v'chasima tova.
Rebbe, thank you very much. Ksiva siva tova. Amitz Hashem, we will begin anew again when we have Tzom Gedalia. Well, Amitz Hashem will call on Rebbe another time for that. Thank you very much. Take care.
Call.
Bye-bye.